I want to thank all you for coming out on this cold and wet evening. I appreciate that dedication. The city's having a series of these town meetings around the city to try to get present to the constituents what the city's thinking on the draft climate action plan, to get some more feedback on it, and then those recommendations are that there'll be a revised plan that'll come back to council in a month or so. So I want to first, as I said, thank everybody for coming out on this cold, wet night. We're going to have Timothy Burles, who's sort of the head of our climate action stuff, give a little overview, and then one of our residents, Bruce Reardon, is going to talk a bit on some of the science and some of the impacts, and then Timothy will actually walk us through the plan, and then there'll be time for some discussion. So, Timothy, you want to start?
Yeah. Thank you, Councilmember Wozniak. I appreciate you hosting this event, and again, thanks to all of you for coming out in this wonderful weather. My name is Timothy Burroughs. I work in the Office of Energy and Sustainable Development at the City of Berkeley, which is actually housed in the Planning Department. It was housed in the Housing Department until, it's probably been 6 or 8 months now that we moved over to the Planning Department. But my job at the city is really to coordinate the development of the draft Berkeley Climate Action Plan. And that's what we're here to talk about this evening. We're here to talk about really a work plan going forward for our community for reducing greenhouse gas emissions here locally. And this all started actually back in November 2006. There was a ballot measure on the local ballot that asked the voters of Berkeley, should we as a community establish an aggressive greenhouse gas emissions reduction target? It was specifically an 80% reduction in community-wide emissions by 2050. And should we develop a plan for achieving that target? That was Measure G on the ballot. And 81% of us voted yes. And so we all agree that we have to do something here locally, or the large majority of us agree that we have to do something here locally on this global issue of climate change. It doesn't mean that we all agree on what that something is. And so this process that we've been sort of going through for about the past year is to provide as many opportunities as possible for residents in Berkeley, employees that work in Berkeley, employers of Berkeley, as many people as possible give the opportunity to contribute to what our climate action plan should look like. And the draft climate action plan that is out now for public comment until January 16th, is really the product of a lot of meetings like this. And so it's a product of a lot of community input over a lot of months. And that process is still ongoing, so there's a few more opportunities to provide input on the plan. And I should say that the plan is never final. It's really going to be a living document that goes on and that we adjust and adapt as conditions demand. But we are hoping to provide a final draft to council early in the new year that council will decide whether or not to adopt. And then really the energy will go into implementing that climate action plan that council adopts. So I've done enough of these meetings to realize that many of us have differing opinions on what should be done in Berkeley to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I think that's a beautiful thing. And all I ask for us to do tonight is to share your opinions, share your ideas, and respect the fact that you might disagree with your neighbor and he or she might disagree with you, and that's okay. This is an opportunity to get everything out and be respectful to one another, and what we're going to do is we're going to make sure that we record everything that we hear tonight and do our best to integrate your comments into the climate action plan before we take it back to council for adoption. Climate change is a global issue, but it has local impacts, and many of the solutions to this global issue are local. And so what I'm going to do a little bit later is go through the plan, which shares a number of the potential local solutions. But what I first want to do is turn it over to Bruce Reardon, who's actually lives in this district just down the road. And Bruce is going to talk a little bit more about what the latest is on the science and the impacts of climate change. I think we'll find that it's actually welcome. Come on in.
Before we turn over to Bruce, I just want to acknowledge that Chris Worthington joined us, and also Neil's, I don't remember Neil's last name, from the mayor's office, is also here, and so joining us. So, Bruce, go ahead.
One last thing I'll say is that there is a sheet that was on your chair when you got in. Have a look at that, and if you're so moved, answer the questions. We'll be collecting those at the end of the meeting, and again, it's another way to get your feedback on what the plan should look like and what are some of the barriers to action locally. Executive summaries are available in the back, and I have a few full plans here that people can take. And if people want a full hard copy of the plan, you can email me after the meeting, and I can get another one to you. The last thing I'll say is if you want to be on the mailing list to keep up with climate-related activities in Berkeley and the Climate Action Plan, I'm going to pass this around. You can put your email down here. It's up to you whether you want to be on that list or not. Yes?
What is the name of your department?
The office is the Office of Energy and Sustainable Development. And that office is in the Planning Department. And that too. Okay, now Bruce Reardon. Bruce wears many hats. He is currently working as a consultant for the regional agencies, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and the Association of Bay Area Governments. And he is sort of advising those agencies on how to move forward on the climate issue as a region. Bruce was also trained directly by Vice President Al Gore on Al Gore's presentation, the Inconvenient Truth presentation. And so that's where he got his start, doing presentations like this, talking about the impacts of the science of global warming. So I'm going to turn it over to Bruce for a few minutes, and then I'll come back on and walk us through the Climate Action Plan.
Thanks, Timothy. So I have the Al Gore slideshow down to 5 slides. So Timothy asked me to provide some context, you know, for why we're doing a Climate Action Plan in Berkeley, just to set the stage for the discussion. You're all here because you're aware in various degrees of climate change and the risks that we're facing, the impacts that we're facing. So I'm just going to underline 5 slides, 5 words, and we'll take it from there and turn it back to Timothy, because it's really about hearing from all of you here tonight. And I couldn't help, since I grew up in this neighborhood, slipping in a slide, because you don't often get to do slideshows in your own neighborhood, but if you were sitting, Pete's is here, Rick and Ann's is here. If you were sitting out there having coffee or breakfast, you'd be run over by the train if you were back in 1957.
Let's bring that back.
Train. So, little side note, if you take that driveway into the parking lot, I would say the Jackson's parking lot, but Jackson's is not there anymore, whatever is there, that's the old route of the train. That is the actual train tracks that came off of Claremont right before what was the firehouse and turned in there.
Wow.
So a little local history. Fun to throw in those pictures.
Oh, I thought that it was a streetcar going up Russell Street.
There was a streetcar up Russell Street, but this was the key system trains that ran to San Francisco. Ran to the ferries in the old days. You took a ferry to the city, and when the bridge was completed, starting in 39, 2 years after the bridge was completed, these trains went all the way up. And I'm fortunate enough to have gone on these trains. I was 8 when they took them out, and we had great fun standing on French on their school watching the trains run over our coins on the tracks. Anyway, that's not why we're here. So 5 slides. Number one, and a word for each one now, is the word here. We talk a lot about impacts of global warming that are going to happen in mid-century and beyond. You see a lot of projections, but the truth of it is, in addition to those projections, we're seeing very significant changes in the world from global warming now. We're seeing Arctic ice melts, we're seeing glacial melts on all continents, we're seeing a significant increase in extreme rainfall events and flooding on a series of continents, droughts in other places, a whole set of things that are going on now. For the future, it's really about choices, and this is one of many slides of the State of California put together. This is showing extreme heat days. So think of the 20 hottest days of the year wherever you live. That's the definition of the extreme heat days. And this is projecting for 3 different futures, a lower warming, a medium, and a higher, the increase that we would see in those extreme heat days. So you're talking about a serious increase even with the lower warming scenario, which we're going to have. If we end up with a medium warming scenario, by this is all projected end of the century, you're talking in San Francisco another 80 days on top of those 20 that are the hottest days of the year. And if you're going the highest warming scenario and we're really off the charts, you're talking catastrophic changes. So the point here is this is not one warming future. that we are headed towards. There are a series of futures, and a lot of what happens here in mid-century and beyond is up to what we do. There is power here working with our brothers and sisters worldwide to affect which of these futures our children, our grandchildren, and beyond are going to live in. So there's power here. There's power. The third is a sense of urgency. You know, too often I think with problems that we face, especially in this culture at this point, we tend to want to take forever to talk and talk and deliberate and talk. This one's about the sense that we can do that, but we're going to be in a lot more trouble the longer we wait to move. So this one shows worldwide business as usual track for CO2 emissions projected up to about mid-century. And actually, if you did this chart now, this was done a couple years ago, it would be a little steeper because we've actually, in the last couple years, been growing at close to 3% a year in terms of global emissions. So this is where we're headed. These are both from the Stern report that was done for Tony Blair's government, are better paths to take. Leveling off emissions worldwide in the next 10, maybe 15 years, and then starting a gradual descent. These lead you to still futures that are much warmer, but they're much better futures than this one. This is catastrophic, you know, staying on this path. The point of this one is you can wait, and then you have a much steeper plunge to get to these points off into the future. That is very risky. You can set in motion processes in the physical world that you can't reverse. It's also probably much more expensive to wait and go up this line and then plunge to this level. It's much better to start in a gradual manner in the next 10 to 15 years worldwide and push down. It's always better for every species to change in a slow manner like that.
Is the cumulative still going? That's just the emissions per year, right?
Yes.
The cumulative is still rising.
Yes.
Even with the two.
This is emissions per year as opposed to the concentration in the atmosphere. You're just trying to slow the rate of increase and then start to. This is starting to level it off eventually. And this is aiming at 450. If you know your numbers, 550 parts per million or 450. There's a lot of science now that 350 is really where we need to be targeted, which is even more of a drop than here. James Hansen, our leading scientist, is on the 350 push now, and Al Gore just came out at the conference the other day and endorsed the 350 as well, which was new for Gore. So these are moderate. This is keeping you from catastrophic change here.
Not at 450.
Well, it's debatable.
You've got basically a bathtub that's filling up and a drain you're trying to empty at the same time.
So, last slide.
You're going to drain a fire hose and you've got a small drain. In a dynamic system, you're going to still overflow.
Thank you. The law here is the last slide. The state of California has passed AB 32 and they just last week approved the what's called the scoping plan to put it into effect. We're the first state to cap emissions. And capping emissions, this is where about where we are in terms of total emissions, greenhouse gas emissions in California. This is where we're projected to be in the year 2020. And the state, with its new law, is capping emissions and saying we're going to reduce emissions in 2020 back to what they were in 1990. So it's about a 30% drop. This is a political target. It's not a science target. It's a political target. And the state said, come up with something that we can do. Come up with something that we can reach. Come up with something that is a stretch but is doable. So we are slated, and they just came up with a plan of how to get this 170 or so million metric tons a year reduced through a variety of means that will take both state, regional, and local action. But the real thing to focus on here, well, this is AB 32, and this is our law now. This is the real one, and it's what your City of Berkeley plan is based on. This is the science goal. That by mid-century...
The law, what is the teeth? Do you know what the teeth are in that law?
The teeth in AB 32?
Yeah.
There are cap and trade restrictions.
Just gums, or...
There are cap and trade, we can talk about it later, cap and trade restrictions on certain industries. There are regulations that are going to have a force of law. They have to set the regulations over the next 2 years in terms of how they're going to implement the plan. If you go to climate change, CaliforniaClimateChange.org, you can see all the stuff on 32.
Do you have like three industries, major ones that you could mention?
Well, transportation and buildings are our two biggest, and Timothy will talk about this in terms of looking at California, looking at the region, and looking at Berkeley.
Good.
We're not too different. Buildings, energy for buildings, and transportation are pretty much the two biggest. Yeah?
How does the Berkeley goal relate to the previous slide?
It's pretty close to... And this all gets back to climate sensitivities, which I don't want to spend a lot of time on. We're here to talk about your plan. But getting here is pretty close to this same goal here, an 80% reduction below 1990. Mm-hmm. This is 14 tons per person, every single person in California. This is 10 tons per person because we're getting population increase. This is 1.5 tons. This is a very, very significant change from 14 to 10 to 1.5.
Now, and so, 2050.
Yes.
And so, on the previous slide, where's 2050? And so, what would that line look like?
They aren't entirely the same science, but 2050 is here. So, you're talking again about a 2/3 reduction probably in this graph, and this one is an 80%. So, the math is, there's different sensitivities, different math going on here. So, the last slide here is on hope. So, that's all a pretty serious, set of issues that we're up against. Very, very serious. There is tremendous hope based on the kinds of things, and these are just 9 of my slides. I have a couple hundred of these, just projects in the Bay Area. We have seen, before we get to regulations and laws and plans, a whole set of what are called voluntary reductions taken by businesses. This is Adobe in San Jose that spent $3 million on energy efficiency for their cutting their energy bill by about 40% and made their money back in 3 or 4 years. Solar, this is a company in Santa Clara County that gave $3,000 to each employee that would buy a hybrid. We're finally starting to plan transit and transportation, biking and walking along with land use, and this is Fruitvale Transit Village. We're finally doing the fact that faster transit actually attracts people. This is Caltrain's baby bullet. They chopped a half an hour off the run to San Jose from San Francisco and increased transit use there by 30%. Solar wineries, community groups, a whole set of things. We have a tremendous amount of good work being done in the Bay Area and in California and the country. And now the choice and the chance now is to build on that, institutionalize some of these things, and do a lot more. These are just a good start. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bruce. So what I'd like to do now is I'd like to talk a little bit about local solutions to this global issue. I'd like to give an overview of the Berkeley's draft climate action plan. And the main goal of tonight is to provide you an opportunity for feedback and for discussion and questions. And so I'm going to try and give an overview that's fairly high level, but with some specifics in it. If I went through the whole plan measure by measure, we'd be here for about 6 hours. So I'm not going to do that tonight. But I want to give you enough of a taste that you have enough information to ask questions about, and encourage you, if you haven't already, to go back and look at the plan in depth.
Here you go.
Thank you. First thing I want to do is I want to show you a snapshot of Berkeley's greenhouse gas emissions for the year 2005. This was an emissions inventory conducted by an organization called ICLEI, the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. And ICLEI pretty much provides the standard for local communities across the world on how to measure greenhouse gas emissions at the local level. There are limits to this inventory, but it's a very useful tool, especially for policymaking, because it helps you understand, in general, where do our emissions come from in our community? And if you know that, then you can figure out where to target your solutions. So a couple of things jump out about this inventory. One is that the single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Berkeley is our own driving, our own trips to the store, dropping kids off at school, driving to work. About 29% of Berkeley's total greenhouse gas emissions come from gasoline consumption. That's our automobiles. Another thing that's interesting about the inventory is that emissions from natural gas in the commercial sector here and also in the residential sector here really dwarf the emissions that result from electricity in Berkeley. We don't use much air conditioning here, which would be a lot of electricity. We do use heat for our water and to heat our homes. That's a lot of natural gas. We also have a relatively, relatively clean. What I mean by that, relatively clean electricity mix. If you were to compare the types of energy used to generate Berkeley's electricity versus the types of energy used to generate electricity in West Virginia, PG&E's mix is much cleaner. It's mostly hydro. There's some nuclear there, which is has a lot of issues, obviously, but when you consume it, it's lower emissions than, for example, coal. The other thing about the inventory is it helps you track emissions over time. So if I do an inventory in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, I can see how Berkeley's emissions change over time. So it's a useful tool for that reason, for helping to track a trend and also to target emissions reduction strategies. Just because I thought you'd be interested, I wanted to show you this same breakdown for the state of California.
That is interesting.
And you can see that, again, the state, as a state as a whole, similar to Berkeley, transportation is the main source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. And that's not only because we love our cars in California, though many parts of California do love their cars, but we have, a relatively clean electricity mix, and California is way out in front on things like energy efficiency standards that bring down the emissions from the other sectors. I also wanted to throw this in. This is also quite interesting. This is emissions for our region, the Bay Area. And you can see very similar to Berkeley, about 50% of total greenhouse gas emissions for the Bay Area come from the transportation sector. That's, large trucks, diesel, but it's also passenger vehicles, mostly passenger vehicles, our driving trips. So an inventory certainly shows where our emissions come from, and we're very much part of the problem. But because we're responsible for all these emissions, we can also be very much part of the solution. We have a lot of power to control how big the different sections in this pie is and how many total emissions that this pie represents. So I want to talk now about the Berkeley Climate Action Plan, because the Climate Action Plan is really all about solutions. What can we do here locally to address a global issue? And I've heard it said before that it doesn't matter what one city does. It doesn't matter if Berkeley reduces its emissions to zero. It doesn't matter at all. And I think that is true in one way. If Berkeley did reduce its emissions to zero, it probably would not affect global climate change. But the thing about what we do in Berkeley is that it doesn't stay in Berkeley. And that's not only the city of Berkeley. Cities copy off of each other all over the place. So what we can do here locally, what solutions we can put forth here locally, will happen elsewhere. The other thing about local government action is it affects state policy. And when you can affect state policy, you're affecting a much larger swath of the population. And we generally know that what happens in California ends up spreading east. So we do have power to affect things here. What we do here matters. That's important to remember. So let's talk about the draft climate action plan. Again, the action plan is really the result of a lot of meetings like this. There's been a series of drafts that have been posted on the web. A lot of people have commented directly on the website. And so it's really a community-led effort and the product of a robust community process. So think back to that piece of that pie. And let's start with the transportation section of the pie and talk about what are some solutions proposed in the Climate Action Plan to address those transportation-related emissions. First of all, it's kind of interesting to think about the transportation challenge, that is, reducing emissions from the transportation sector, as a three-legged stool, okay? This stool needs all three of its legs to stand. If one of those legs is not there, the stool will fall over, okay? So when you think about all the different policy mechanisms for reducing transportation-related emissions, one is the efficiency of our vehicles, fuel efficiency. Who largely controls fuel efficiency standards? Is it Berkeley?
Congress.
It's the state, and it's also the federal government.
The price of gasoline.
It's an important component, and there's certainly economic signals as well. It's an important component of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It's a component that is generally controlled by other levels of government. The city of Berkeley can promote the use of more efficient vehicles and provide free parking spaces for electric vehicles and things like that. But in large part, it's the state and federal government that affect how fuel efficient our vehicles are. And right now, the state is trying to do just that through the Pavley bill, which would significantly increase the fuel efficiency of our vehicles. The federal government has challenged it. Obama has said that when he comes to office, he will let it go through. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question for you. Maybe before, when I posted before. But our transportation in Berkeley is highly dependent on our altitude above sea level. And so have you looked at, or taken a quick look at, how much of our usage is related to altitude?
No.
We know that's a fact, so we don't know what the spread is.
We haven't looked at that, and perhaps we can follow up after, because I'm not familiar with the connection. So let's talk about that after.
Oh, I keep it simple, and I can say it in a minute, which is it costs a lot more fuel. A car that's getting 50 miles to the gallon gets less than 20 if it goes up to the top of
the hill.
Of the hill.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Right.
So there's a lot more fuel going up the hill, and the lower down the hill you are, the more efficient you are.
Right.
And there's another factor. The lower down the hill you are, the closer you are to good mass transit. Mm-hmm. How much does that represent? How much are we hobbled by our hillside in hitting our goal?
Yeah. Oh, it's a good question. I mean, one of the things that's come up a lot in the public process is residents of the hills that really want to drive a lot less, realizing that they have to drive everywhere to meet their needs almost. There are a few bus lines that run up there. But in general, it's very difficult to get around without a car if you're a Hills resident. And that's come up a lot. And the Climate Action Plan does take some time to address that. And we can talk about some of the solutions I'm going to get to in a minute, so we'll get back to that. Do you have a question,
too? Can we tax cars locally? Can we tax gas cars in Berkeley?
There already is a tax on cars, but it's not local control. I believe it's either statewide or regionally controlled.
But is local control illegal?
I think it is. We've discussed it.
It has to go through the state, I think.
I think it's included.
There are other ways to do that, which we can talk about too. All right, another leg of the stool is the carbon content of how much carbon dioxide is in our fuels when we consume them. And again, this is something that's largely controlled at the state level. And again, the state is proposing, as part of AB 32, the scoping plan that was recently adopted by the Air Resources Board, a low-carbon fuel standard. I believe that started as an executive order from the governor and has since been integrated into the state's climate action plan, basically. And then there's how much we drive, the miles we drive. That's a third leg of the stool. There's a lot of control that local governments have, how much we drive. We can control that in a number of different ways. And a number of those ways are suggested in the Climate Action Plan. And all of the ways that the Climate Action Plan suggests, I like to think of it as a puzzle. And each of these puzzle pieces represents part of the solution. So the question that we've been asking you, the community, and the question we've been asking ourselves over time is, what does each puzzle piece represent? How can we assemble those pieces to really develop a community, live in a community that it's easier to get around without driving? All right, let's talk about some of those solutions. One is existing public transit. We have a BART station there. We have bus lines rolling right up to the BART station in downtown Berkeley. There are parts of Berkeley where access to public transit is great. There are parts of Berkeley where access to public transit is miserable. So the Climate Action Plan takes on that issue. How can we enhance public transit in Berkeley to make it easier, more accessible, more fast, more frequent for our community? Other modes of transportation other than sort of conventional public transit, like car share, for example, where a number of households share one vehicle. You log on online, you can reserve a car for a certain period of time, you take it back, somebody else takes it and moves on. Car share is an underutilized mode of alternative transportation that has to be used more in our community.
But how does that affect greenhouse gas? You're still burning gas.
It affects greenhouse gas emissions in a couple of ways. One, car share vehicles are generally much more fuel efficient than the average vehicle. Number two is that studies have shown that car share members actually get rid of personal vehicles and drive less. So it affects how much people drive and how fuel efficient the vehicles are that they drive, and in that way it reduces greenhouse gas emissions. Bicycling and walking. Huge part of how we get around in Berkeley, but if we're going to achieve our greenhouse gas emission reduction target, people have to do it more. And in order for people to do it more, they have to feel safer. A lot of people don't ride their bike or they don't walk because they don't feel safe, especially if you have kids. So that's come up a lot in this climate action planning process.
Are there proposals to like make roads no cars?
There are. There are closing streets for certain periods of a month. There's closing streets for one day a month. Stuff like that has come up. There are community members that have suggested closing streets all together. So that's come up a lot in the public in the public comment period. Yeah.
You don't mention taxis or other kind of car services.
Taxis are mentioned in the plan. I didn't mention them yet here.
Okay.
But they are mentioned as the plan. Now, whether taxis will reduce greenhouse gas emissions or not is another story. That depends on if it affects how much people would drive anyway. But taxis can be a very, very useful alternative form of transportation, alternative to owning your own car. Yes, in the back. You, sir. Yes.
Have you accounted for the policies and practices at Berkeley that are increasing the mileage that people drive?
Give me some examples.
Well, for example, in the last couple of years, I know at least 20 woodworkers who've lost manufacturing space in West Berkeley. People who do the housing renovation, who maintain the housing stock,
mm-hmm.
they're now driving an extra 20 gallons cumulatively
mm-hmm.
a day,
mm-hmm.
or 400 miles
yep.
a day. And that's all because the city's doing nothing about maintaining reasonably priced manufacturing space,
mm-hmm.
giving it to places like Wines.com, which has got big box trucks driving mm-hmm. around picking up and delivering stuff.
So that issue,
you're adding to it.
Yeah, that issue is incredibly complicated. But the Climate Action Plan doesn't address it. It doesn't directly address specifically woodwork. Hold on, let me answer your question.
Being forced to spend more on gas and drive more.
Let me answer your question. What you're talking about is a land use issue, and the city has a lot of control over the types of land uses that are available in our community. Now, there have been a lot of changes in Berkeley, and the types of land uses have changed over time. And there's a lot of different ways of looking at that. The goal of the Climate Action Plan is to match types of land uses to types of jobs, so that people ultimately have to drive less. So that people that live in Berkeley can work in Berkeley, people that work in Berkeley can live in Berkeley. That's ultimately the goal of the Climate Action Plan. I
can give you examples of people who do live in Berkeley, who used to work in Berkeley.
Yeah, I understand.
And whose work is primarily in Berkeley,
yep.
whose additional greenhouse gases are caused by the city's own decision.
I understand.
Shouldn't the city find some way to credit them for having to do the stuff that they lived in Berkeley
yep.
to try and avoid doing?
I understand. It's a tough challenge.
Those are the land use decisions you're making, though.
There's lots of land use decisions being made. I think we have to move on to another question. But yes.
Yeah, so the bike's great.
Uh-huh.
And I remember wonderful biking in Berkeley many years ago. But it is a flatland activity.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to see what you might propose to deal with bringing biking up the hill.
Because people can ride down, it's just harder to ride up.
It's an up part. Actually, the down part is also.
That's a lot of fun riding down. I think one of the ways that the plan addresses that is more capacity on transit that runs up the hills to carry bikes. So, for example, a lot of people have said, I tried my bike, I want to hop on the bus, but the bike rack in the front of the bus is full, and so I can't do it. And that issue comes up a lot. And so as we look at ways of getting more shuttles up into the hills, more buses up into the hills, those buses have to be able to carry people's bikes so they can get up the hill with their bikes and then ride back down.
And we also, that means more buses going up the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And that means more heavy buses being lifted up the hill and losing all that energy coming down the hill. And even more inefficient.
Yeah, well, I think what we should do is probably flatten the hill.
Is that in the plan?
Flattening the hill, I'll put that in the plan.
No, there was something that you can do that, in fact, I suggested you consider doing in the plan.
We talked on the phone.
That's right.
That's right, I remember that. Yeah.
You want to talk about it?
Can we? Do you mind if we move on? So we have, because I want to give other people a participation. But you do have a good idea. I mean, essentially, we have to find ways to get people up the hills with their bicycles. And there's a couple of different ways of looking at that. But I want to move on for now, so we can get some other questions.
I just think you're on the money on safety. I used to have 30 employees. They would never take BART because they didn't feel comfortable walking the two blocks of the BART station at night, mm-hmm. especially women. And even though we had the commuter checks and the whole business, safety is an enormous issue just getting to public transit.
Absolutely. A lot of parents don't feel safe with their kids riding their bikes either. So land use is another key component of the solution. We know that people drive less when they live in close proximity to transit, really 20 to 40% less people drive when they live in close proximity to transit. And this issue here is a subject of lots of debate in Berkeley. And in communities across the country. And we're going to talk a little bit more about each of these quickly. Cognizant of the time, because I want to make sure I save plenty of time at the end here. Wow. Okay. So public transit, that first box, that picture came out, public transit, so buses and BART. Some of the specific recommendations in the plan, really more frequent service is one of the big ones for AC Transit. AC Transit provides invaluable service to us. They recognize that there's room for improvement. We recognize that there's room for improvement. And we have to work together to identify areas where more frequent service would make the biggest difference. Obviously, funding is an issue for everything in the Climate Action Plan. And AC Transit's funding is chronically cut. So we have to talk about where we can identify more frequent service, but also making it just easier to ride the bus. Real-time signs at the bus station so you know when the next bus is coming. And you don't have to wait wondering, is the bus going to come? Am I going to be here for 20 minutes or am I going to be here for 3 minutes? And that's a really important component. BART is really interested in its ridership and increasing its ridership. And one of the ways to do that is a shuttle network that gets people to the BART station. For example, some people might not take the BART simply because the BART is maybe a mile or more away from where they work. So if there was just a shuttle to fill that last mile-long gap, people might take the BART, hop on that shuttle, and take it to work. And so BART is very interested in working with the city of Berkeley to build a series of shuttle networks to get people to where they want to go. Bus rapid transit is a process that's ongoing in Berkeley. The Climate Action Plan is not the last word on bus rapid transit. There's a long public process that has to happen here. There is potential for bus rapid transit to offset future transportation demand. We have about 2 million more people moving to the Bay Area. In the next 20 years, we're going to have about 1 million more cars. We have to think about, in the future, how are people going to get around? Because if we all drive, then we're going to be moving very slowly. There's going to be a lot of congestion, and we're not going to achieve our greenhouse gas emission reduction goal. And one of the reasons that people do or do not ride transit is how much it costs. So eco passes, zones within Berkeley where transit is free for residents and employees is another one of those points where, you know, if you're just trying to push more people, shift the balance towards public transit, how much public transit costs is one of the issues that you have to tackle. Yeah.
I'm curious, when you say free transit passes, they're free for the people who are riding, but who really pays for it? Is it a tax? Or some other thing. What do you mean by free?
No free lunch, right?
So, exactly.
Somebody has to pay for it. And there are a couple of different ways you could pay for it. I would think, you know, one of the reasons that this might be difficult is because we have to figure out how to pay for it. And Councilmember Worthington, you might have some ideas on this. I know EcoPass is one of the things that you talk about a lot, and one of the questions that does come up is how do we pay for it? The plan recommends a couple of different potential ways that have to do with parking pricing and carbon tax, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But if there are other ideas that...
Could we have a shoe fund and just ship push around the world?
I just wanted to give you an opportunity if you wanted it.
I believe if Berkeley was to apply to the state for funding for an EcoPass in the downtown and Telegraph Corridor, that it would be very competitive and likely to be funded. So that would just be for the employees of the downtown and Telegraph. It wouldn't cover the whole city, but it would be a big step forward.
Why don't we just tax ourselves? Let's just put a property tax assessment in for your AC Transit pass, and everyone gets a free one, or what, a quote-unquote free one. You know what I'm saying?
Nobody's going to pass it.
Dirty T-words.
I don't know.
It has potential. I mean, you have to ask yourself, A lot of what's in the climate action plan represents action that goes beyond what we're doing right now. And it takes additional revenue. And the question is, how do you generate that revenue?
I'll bet
tax is one way. There are other ways. Yeah.
When you'd save it on your vehicle licensing because you wouldn't have a car, so you'd save a lot of money and you just pay the tax. So there you go. But the other thing is that when you do the passes, one of the things we need to do, I think, right now, is coordinate it. So you would have one pass that's like fast track,
and
you can use it on AC Transit, you can use it on Muni, you can use it on BART, whole region wide. And that's a convenience matters.
Definitely.
And I don't want to have to fumble for change or whatever.
Definitely.
One pass.
Yeah.
It's more attractive.
Yeah, go ahead.
Just as a point, we have an electronic pass now that works on AC Transit, on Golden Gate, and on Muni, and BART is next.
Okay.
And BART will be within the next 6 months.
Oh, really?
Okay, in the back, and then you.
This is a little bit off topic, but I would like to see Berkeley lead the way towards progressive taxation rather than regressive taxation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not only sales tax, but sometimes property tax can be very regressive as well.
Indeed. Thank you. Kelly, do you mind looking at a flip chart? It's over there. I don't want to miss anybody.
So,
Thanks.
This looks like the chart where Milo's suggestion might fit.
All right, throw it out there. Go ahead.
Because it's in the F's, it fits right at the bottom of the empty space of initiative for Berkeley. A little railroad that runs from downtown right up the hill to the hall signs or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It then services laterally all the hills on by bicycle, however, people can move up and down the hill, and the funicular can be a regenerative one, meaning the energy that it uses to go up the hill, it recovers coming back down and sells back to PG&E.
Mm-hmm.
It's at least a reasonable suggestion.
It's a clever idea.
Why didn't an Obama administration defund it?
Yeah,
I think it's a good idea.
The discounts for seniors and students are very substantial, and I would think studying that, I'm sure it increases usage. And there may be some other major target groups.
Mm-hmm. It's a good idea. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I don't see any too much mention of open space and parks.
Mm-hmm.
And Berkeley has relatively fewer parks and open space, and all this talk about transit and housing. I haven't seen one new park open up. I mean, there are parts of town where there's no green.
Yeah.
So where does that fit into your...
You could take the funicular up to the 25 miles of Berkeley up.
Again, it's
I'm talking about urban parks.
Yeah, and it's key, and it is in the climate action plan. Again, I'm sorry I can't hit on everything here, and so some things look like they're missing. But you know, land use is one of those things, and we're talking about wanting more people to ride their bikes or walk. People aren't going to do that in a concrete jungle where those cars are being by everywhere. And so, you know, more housing and more jobs near transit just not just mean more buildings. It means more walkable communities. It means paying attention to your sidewalks and your crosswalks, your green space, your parks.
I was talking about parks, though.
Yeah.
Not housing, specifically parks and open space.
Yes, and I'm answering your question. And that's specifically addressed in the Climate Action Plan. It actually recommends an open space fee. So anytime there's any new development, that new developer has to contribute money that would be then used to create additional green space and open space within the community. It's a key component.
It's a requirement already. It's just never been implemented.
Mm-hmm.
Just adding to that idea of parks, I guess the original park district was developed not here, but in the more formerly rural areas, hiking and biking trails that connect up the original parks.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole idea is to bring trails down into the urban areas. Now, of course, those kinds of trails would encourage people to walk much more than now. If we could figure out how to get our creeks lined with walkways or do other types of things that would give us more of a green space to walk back and forth.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I don't understand where the land is going to come from that's going to be turned into walkways and so on. I would say every square inch of the city is owned by somebody or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're going to put a walkway along a creek, the creek has to be daylighted, and that is going to be through somebody's backyard or side yard or driveway or something. And so I think with a built-up city, you can't make sweeping changes like this unless you're going to be using eminent domain, and I think that would be a real fighting point.
Yeah, I think they, to a large degree, you're right, although I think there's a bit more wiggle room than you might expect. And one of the things that the Climate Action Plan recommends is that we actually take some time and do a scenario study. So look at the land that is available in Berkeley and that's not available in Berkeley and see how we might use it either the same or differently than we use it now. And really paint a picture for the community that we can debate as a community. How should we be using our land in a way that reduces greenhouse gas emissions, increases green space, promotes bicycling and walking? I don't think we're going to be able to answer that question right now. But I think taking a look at different scenarios is important.
And I have another concern. Right at the moment, we're supposed to be cutting back on water usage, and I'm doing my very best. But most large residential bulk unit buildings have one water meter. And so there's no way for me to
monitor
the usage of individual units. And so I think there needs to be some cooperation that would, I just wonder if we're adding all this population, like ABAG continues to tell us we have to do, where is the water going to come from for those new people that are going to be coming in?
Yeah, and one of the things you have to look at is sub-metering. So any kind of new development, each unit should have be able to monitor.
But even existing housing, how can you hold them to a standard? Because we can't get new meters put in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good. That's a good question.
Mm-hmm. The two issues that I don't know if you're going to bring up if they're in the action plan, but there's one thing the city does which almost explicitly encourages driving, and that's school assignment.
Yes.
Yeah.
I live down the street across the street from the school, and my kids are not allowed to go to school there. We have to drive a couple miles away, and we do all sorts of sharing and using the bus, but still, if my wife wants to volunteer, she has to drive down there. It's a lot of driving, and I see all the cars driving to the school in the morning, and essentially, the city is encouraging people to drive because of this. It seems like this has to be a large portion of the trips.
That has come up. It's not currently addressed in the plan, although for the version that we're working on now, we're trying to address it.
People are going to avoid it because politically they don't like it, but it's just going to have to happen. The other issue is traffic. Mm-hmm. Traffic in Berkeley, I'm sure, is partially a result of the engineering. Streets are blocked and
partially a result? Totally a result.
They're blocked for miles on one street, but the cross street that where it's originating, there's no traffic at all. And that's just simply the engineering. And it's almost as if Berkeley wants traffic, which is not good for emissions. And no one seems to be doing anything about it. They don't seem to talk about it or fix it.
Yeah.
Is that in the plan at all?
Not really. I mean, traffic calming and sort of more efficient traffic
It's traffic calming leads to that.
Traffic routes as well. I mean, just...
The diverges is traffic calming.
Yeah, I wasn't finished.
But there doesn't seem to be any sensors involved with metering the traffic. It's just, this is what it's time for, and it just backs up for miles at this time of the day.
Right. It's an issue. Well, I appreciate you bringing it up. Yeah.
How does UC Berkeley get incorporated in all this? Because not only do they have, I don't know how many hundreds and hundreds of people coming to the Colcott Tunnel every day, and parking, people don't even live here. All the students who have all these cars that are parked all over the lawns and they're parked all over the streets.
Yep.
Seems like you could eliminate people on campus not to have a car, have them park somewhere else or by the bus station. And the people could be shuttled from BART to the tunnel to the campus instead of everybody in their own.
So they wouldn't have to drive, yeah. UC Berkeley is incorporated in a couple of different ways. It's sort of integrated throughout. One, where specifically we talk about UC Berkeley and the plan that we've talked with UC Berkeley about is how do we identify more housing for within Berkeley for people that work at the university. UC is the largest employer in our community, obviously, and so a significant amount of the vehicle miles traveled in that pie chart are due to people driving into Berkeley that work at the university. So how can we collectively look at potential housing options for people that work at the university so they can live closer to where they work? That's one specific example of how we highlight it. I should also mention that UC Berkeley has its own climate action planning process, and one of the things they're looking at specifically is their transportation, their vehicle miles traveled. So And so they're developing their own climate action plan to have their own inventory. They're out in front as compared to most universities in the country. Here and then there. Yeah.
I came late, and you may have addressed this in the very beginning. Uh-huh. But my question pertains to how measurement will go along with this process. 25-30 years ago, we set a standard for the state by saying we want to recycle a certain percentage of our waste
yep.
by a certain date. And this, by the time we got there, the state had caught up, and they were saying the same things were better. But we took credit for things like pavement coming off the streets and being recycled. And it was already being what we called that recycling. So you can create, make the numbers by how you measure what you're calling greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, you talk about CO2. I don't know if you address methane. I mean, if I eat less meat and I live in Berkeley, do we get credit? If I drive 6,500 miles outside of Berkeley and ride my bike all year in Berkeley, does that hurt or help? Mm-hmm. I mean, what are we counting?
Yep.
Is it, and really, I don't want the answer. I want to know if there's a philosophy in the plan about how to measure, mm-hmm. not what are the measurements. Mm-hmm.
There is. There is a philosophy. And the philosophy starts with how communities across the country measure their greenhouse gas emissions. The inventory that we use to measure our community-level emissions is designed to capture the emissions that the local government has some ability to affect, right? So transportation specifically, it captures vehicle miles traveled within the city limits. If you drive from Berkeley to Oakland, then your vehicle miles traveled, once you cross that city line into Oakland, then your VMT is being captured in Oakland's greenhouse gas emissions inventory.
There is just some set of things that are going to get measured, and then everything else is just going to leave our hands.
No, that's not what I said.
I'm not saying it in a derogatory way. I'm just trying
Look, I mean, this is a global issue. It is not, and again, I did talk about this a little bit in the beginning. And if you rode your bike all year at Berkeley and then you got a Humber so you could drive outside of Berkeley the rest of the year, that would be problematic. And that's why the inventory. That's why the inventory cannot be the only way that you look at greenhouse and gas emissions. You have to work with regional agencies. You have to work with the state government to look at emissions on a regional scale. And that's why the Climate Action Plan talks about, one of the things it talks about is land use. So we make it easier for people to get to Berkeley on alternative forms of transportation that not only affects greenhouse gas emissions in Berkeley, but outside in other cities and in the region as well. But you've hit on something where it's very difficult. There's a lot of limitations on how you can measure greenhouse gas emissions at the community level that capture everything. The food you eat is not necessarily captured in the inventory. Part of it may be captured where, you know, the food that travels through Berkeley or within Berkeley to get to your food, your dinner table, that's captured. But the inventory does not capture, fertilizer that goes into growing your corn and the transportation from Nebraska to California to get your corn to here. It doesn't capture all of that. But that should not mean that we, that does not mean that we have to limit the scope of the types of emissions that we try to affect. Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to try to partially answer that. I mean, it's an imperfect system, but the measurements will evolve. And what we'd really like, it doesn't cover things you buy, purchase, for example, either. You would like to have, you know, a barcode reader on your cell phone, so whatever you bought or whatever you eat, it would actually cumulatively add up all the greenhouse gas emissions. Or when you send manufacturing to China, they don't count that with this sort of model, you know, what share of that we buy back, okay, by having the manufacturing there. And so it's very, very complicated. This is a first start. It has to be improved, and people have to take some personal responsibility outside of what, you know, the city is trying to do within, you know, its scope, okay, in terms of what you do outside of Berkeley or other things.
I'm going to move. I'm going to move on, guys. If you don't mind, I've got a few more slides, and it's already 8, and this ends at 8:30. So I want to make sure we have more opportunity. I already talked about a lot of this, so I'm going to move on. But I just wanted to emphasize quickly that shuttles have to be part of the solution. I'm writing a grant right now to the US EPA to try to get some funding for shuttle development.
Can I just add that those shuttles are incredibly polluting? They should be clean shuttles.
They should be clean shuttles, clean ultra low sulfur diesel. That's actually one of the requirements in the grant proposal. Car share, I mentioned, bicycles and pedestrianism, important part of the solution. Especially on land use.
Shuttle doesn't allow other people.
Yeah, I know, it doesn't. That was just an example of a shuttle. Land use and vehicle miles traveled. Okay, why does the Berkeley Climate Action Plan look at land use? Well, I would posit that a climate action plan that does not look at where you put people is not a climate action plan, right? 20 to 40% less you drive if you live near transit. Those are national studies. There's a clear relationship between where you live and how much you drive. This is a study done by John Holtzclaw that shows the relationship between vehicle miles traveled and where you live. Typical suburb all the way to the left there, five dwelling units per acre, five households per acre. You can look at the annual VMT per household is about 21,000. And you compare that to an urban center like the denser parts of San Francisco, where the typical vehicle miles traveled per household is about 4,000 vehicle miles traveled per household per year. So the relationship is clear. Now, that doesn't mean that Berkeley should look like San Francisco or Manhattan, right? There, that won't happen here. We won't let that happen here. Community members would never let that happen here. Now, just as much as that can't happen here, what is also scary is a one-story development right next to a BART station. To me, that is just as scary as a 100-story high-rise. Both of those are extremes that are difficult, that we can't allow if we're going to achieve our greenhouse gas emissions.
Doesn't it depend which was there first?
What's that?
Doesn't it depend which structure was there first? If you have 1,000 one-story homes near a BART station and the BART station was built later, that's the way it is.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that we should sort of level one-story homes. I'm talking mainly about any new development that goes into Berkeley has to keep in mind where you put it, because where you put it matters to how much people drive, and that's clear. Okay, now there's a lot of debate around that issue, but we have to think about it. Are we going to achieve our greenhouse gas emission reduction goal? That's one of the things that you have to think about. And adaptive reuse of buildings is one of the things we have to think about as well. Sometimes that's appropriate, sometimes that's not. The thing to keep in mind is that this is nothing is black and white. There's lots of gray and there's lots of in between. And this plan is about what we do moving forward. What decisions do we make moving forward as a community? We debate them, and that's good, and that's healthy, and that's what we have to do. There's not always one right, density is not always the right answer, and maintaining one building in one spot is not always the right answer either. There's lots of debate and there's lots of gray area. Yeah?
Okay, well, here's one just a point, a question for you. Parrot Hospital is going to close in the next 5 years. Delta Bates is going to close around 2024. The downtown area plan, which includes the Herrick Zone, refused to consider any relationship between the two hospitals in its planning process. The result is that Berkeley is likely to have no hospital in its future. You have the opportunity to plan for the relocation of the central acute care facility downtown, which is where it used to be, and which, frankly, from my point of view, is a lot more equitable. Mm-hmm. It blends in with the housing. It's halfway or approximately halfway between two mm-hmm. BART stations. The synergies with all kinds of other things that there, and what's currently being planned is to move the hospital to 30th and Telegraph and build a high building, okay, that'll accommodate the extra several hundred beds, okay, with the attendant consequences of staph infections that run rampant in a lot larger facilities, and the distance is traveled to an emergency room, which increases the death rate. Where does this issue of planning for the city's essential services come into this plan?
It's a really good point that you raise. I mean, the Climate Action Plan does not address the siting of the hospital, and I'm not going to be able to answer your question right now. But it's a good point that you raise, for sure.
Could it include that kind of an issue?
Well, I think there's an argument for that the scope would include that, and the the relationship between transportation and where we put our essential care. I think so.
Where in the planning process will that issue arrive?
You just raised it, so it has
arisen. Will the decision for the land use be made before it's ever serious?
I can't answer that question right now. It's a process that's going to happen.
You guys, let's finish talking. Yeah, it's rude to do this.
Since we're running out of time, since 53% of the energy in Berkeley is used on buildings, I'd really like to get to the
buildings. Yeah, thank you.
Let's keep going.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry. I let it track. So here it is. We're at buildings now. So this is a snapshot of where emissions in buildings come from, right? And again, I talked about in the beginning that natural gas is a larger source of greenhouse gas emissions in Berkeley buildings than electricity for a couple of different reasons. So the goal of the Climate Action Plan lays out is to enhance minimum standards, the things that we have to do at minimum, at the same time as providing additional voluntary services to residents and and businesses in Berkeley. So one of the important minimum standards that we currently have is the Residential Energy Conservation Ordinance and its sister ordinance, the Commercial Energy Conservation Ordinance, which says that when a private property turns over, changes hands, there's a certain suite of energy-saving measures that have to be installed. Now, these energy conservation ordinances have been around in Berkeley since the 80s, and they've served our community well, and other communities have copied them. But the Climate Action Plan really recommends moving from a prescriptive approach, where you have to do this set of 10 things, and turning it into more of a performance-based approach, so that when I sell my home, one of the things that would happen is somebody would come to that household and do basically a diagnostics test of that household. Where is energy leaking? Where could energy be saved? And provide a roadmap to the new owner on things he or she could do to make that home more energy efficient. And then each one of those things would be assigned a score. And you'd have to achieve a certain performance when a home turns over or when a business turns over. So it's more of a performance-based approach, much more effective than having to do just a series of things checklist. And so that raises a question. And if more things can be done and we're asking the community to do more things, how are people going to pay to do those things? Now, RECA won't require more than you know people can afford. Right now, it's at a pretty low level that people actually have to pay to put in, attic insulation, weather stripping, change of light bulbs, water saving measures, things like that. But one of the ways that we're advocating that could potentially be used for people to pay for energy improvements in their home and in their business is Berkeley First, our financing initiative for renewable and solar technology. Right now, the city just launched a pilot program for Berkeley First. Basically, the long and short of the program is that the city was looking for a way to help people make their homes go solar, and in the future, hopefully, make their homes more energy efficient. One of the main barriers to putting solar on one's roof is the high upfront cost. And so the city is providing upfront financing to a private property owner. That private property owner will pay back to the city as an incremental assessment on their property tax over 20 years. If I sell my home and a new property owner comes in, then the new property owner picks up the payments for the system. We launched this program the day after the election, I think it was in November. And it was a 40-household pilot, and we got 40 applications within about 10 minutes of the process opening up. You could apply online.
We found out.
All 40 of those households are now going through the process, the paperwork of securing their applications and looking into putting solar on their roofs. Now, right now, the pilot is focused on solar photovoltaics, really solar electric, right? But the idea is that the program be expanded so that financing could be provided to a private property owner for solar thermal, solar hot water, or also for energy efficiency improvement. So if I want to do the insulation, do the new windows, I can get financing from the city to pay for those efficiency improvements and put it on my property tax bill over time. That's the goal. Now, we all know that it is a weird economic time and a scary economic time for many of us. And so one of the keys to this will be, can the city get financing to provide to private property owners over the coming months and years? That's going to be one of the biggest challenges. But that's the goal, is to expand that.
You just took it off our property tax.
Took it off the property tax?
You got credit, reinvest in all those kinds of things. We get it back through a reduction of the property tax. And boom, you've got all that investment stimulating the economy, and you've got all that energy taken out of the system.
And you have more jobs.
It's a good suggestion.
It's a good suggestion.
Yeah, we have a seismic rebate on the transfer tax now, and Council Member Wozniak suggested a green rebate, and I think it's a great idea when a house changes hands to get credit for a certain green improvements. Of course, the city never wants to give up any money, but I think this would be a great suggestion to incorporate into your plan as one of the tax mechanisms. I
appreciate that. Kelly, did you get that?
Many of us own or rent old frame houses, which are very valued in the city of Berkeley and very valued for preservation.
Definitely.
However, these houses are some of the most inefficient as far as energy use and heat. And I think that there should be some attention paid, especially to how people who own those houses can be helped to make their energy efficient. It's very, very expensive.
Yes, sir.
I'm an architect. I've been working on green buildings for about 20 years. I work on advocacy issues for green buildings nationally at the state level. And I read through the chapter on buildings, and I actually thought it was a bit timid. And I think Berkeley could go a lot further. Santa Barbara, for example, is requiring 25% of the title to perform now. I don't see any reason why Berkeley couldn't do that on buildings up to a certain size now, rather than, as the Climate Action Plan says, study how far they can go. I think we can just put some of these things into effect. I think there needs to be a lot more emphasis on improving the building envelope and making buildings more efficient, as opposed to going straight to solar. I'm in the Solar Berkeley First program, so I'm really interested in that too, but you have to do the energy efficiency measures along with that. So
right.
I think there's some really easy ways to dial up the requirements there, which I'm happy to talk to you more about.
Oh, that'd be great. No, I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah.
A lot of homes in Berkeley are obviously rental units, and there's not a lot of incentive for owners of rental units to put in more efficient appliances or insulate windows or do anything. So is there anything to address how... I mean, if you live in the house, then you want to make it more efficient because you'll save money. But if you're renting...
And you're not going to do any structural... If you're a renter, you're not going to do any major changes.
And if you're an owner of a rental property, you're not going to insulate it.
Yes. So yeah, and there is actually significant time committed in the plan to multi-unit buildings. Right now, for example, there's a pass-through that landlords can provide, do upgrades to their buildings, and then pass that cost through to tenants. And the idea is, if tenants save money on energy, save money through benefits achieved through energy efficiency that the landlord implements, then you could raise the cost of rent, the amount that they're saving in energy efficiency benefits. That is complicated enough that it gets used very rarely. And so the Climate Action Plan suggests sort of taking another look at that and seeing where it could be approved. Adding energy efficiency components to the rental housing safety checks that have to go on a regular basis is another idea. There's a series of others, and unfortunately they're not all popping into my head right now, but it's a big issue. It's the split incentive is a big issue, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah. On the water bill, I know when I used more, I get charged extra because it's above my allotment. I got to go turn the sprinkler down. We fight over that. Mm-hmm. But is there the same on the gas bill?
Yes.
If your gas bill is more, do they charge you a lot more? Yes. So can't we just sort of steepen that curve on how much gas people use?
Sure. Look at your bill.
Why don't we steepen it? Make it more expensive, use more gas, and then people would naturally consume.
As a disincentive.
GE's doing that.
They're doing it already.
Well, make it steeper. If you make it steeper, it'll disincentivize you more.
It's a state.
Okay, real quick, okay?
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Presumably you have some idea of what max solar would be in Berkeley, coverage. If we hit that point, how much would that affect greenhouse gas in Berkeley?
It would be a drop in the bucket to offset
Berkeley would be.
If you look at electricity only,
right.
You saw that pie chart.
Right. So it's actually not a very. It's the other things that reduce gases that in fact would be more effective.
Exactly.
Okay.
Solar thermal with radiant heating would do the same thing. Offset the natural gas.
Yes. Exactly, and that's exactly why we want to expand the program to thermal and efficiency. Yeah.
We were looking at Berkeley first, and fortunately it's four times our current electric bills, but what we were thinking about is we're going to get solar when we get an electric car. Mm. So does that scenario, that impacts the transportation segment, so even though a small slice now can't we shift a lot from fossil fuels to solar use?
You can. There are some issues with that. One is that how clean your electric car is depends on the grid electricity that you're getting it, that's powering the car. And second, there's a lot of energy that goes into producing a car. So the best alternative would be to sort of, get an electric car but drive it as little as possible.
I have a somewhat related question. I'm on the pools task force, and we haven't really discussed carbon on it. And the big carbon issues on it, is there a model, whether it's building a house or building a car, versus for weighing these things? And I know we're sort of struggling. It hasn't even really come up, except I brought it up in the pools task force. We're talking about building these big, new, warm water pools. And we're going to have concrete, and we're heating water tonight at 92 degrees. Is there any models that are available to the Parks and Rec Department or to businesses. I mean, it seems like there's models for measuring, you know, energy consumption. There's models on how much something is going to cost. But how do you decide between alternatives on CO or greenhouse gases?
Yeah,
they're very complex.
It is.
There's a lot of work being done on it right now, but it's
hard to find one model that answers all your questions. Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to put in a plug for electric cars and, you know, plug-ins. One of the problems, and you talked about using shuttles, is you have this central transportation. You have like BART and you have places that can take you to San Francisco, but you have to get there from the hills. But electric cars would do that, and our electricity produces very little CO2. It would make a huge impact, and it would allow all those people in the hills, basically, to have a small commute vehicle that's electric and doesn't emit any local CO2 emission. And as I said, PG&E's electricity is pretty good as far as greenhouse gas emissions. It would, I think, have a big impact on our transportation sector.
That's not a realistic solution right now.
So,
yes.
There's also some creative thinking. There's a company called Better Place.
Yes.
They want to hold an electric car.
Yeah.
And you could charge the batteries at night when electricity demand is low. And you basically drop off the depleted battery and pick up a new one.
Yep. Yeah, the electric car, that sort of market is really rapidly...
it's going to happen.
So I want to talk a little bit about waste, and then I'll get your question after that. Another major piece of the solution is recycling and eliminate waste. Again, the inventory doesn't capture that, but that doesn't mean that our solution shouldn't. And I should say that our updated inventory will capture the emissions that result from waste. ICLEI has improved its methodology to capture methane that is emitted from waste decomposing in the landfill, and also the energy consumed to produce new materials versus recycled materials. So one of the main niches in Berkeley that's sort of underserved as far as recycling goes is, again, that multifamily, those multifamily buildings where recycling services are really not as available, especially when compared to a single-family resident. So providing on-site assistance for building managers, multifamily buildings. There's some suggestion that recycling services be made mandatory in multifamily buildings so that the building owner or manager has to provide recycling services. You can include that type of language in a model lease that outlines the responsibility for a building owner to provide recycling services and the responsibility of the tenant to recycle. Right now, California Youth Energy Services does a free basic energy audits in homes throughout Berkeley. The Climate Action Plan recommends integrating a waste audit so the students come into your home, not only look at the energy you're using, but what are some ways that you could reduce waste. Other things that have come up as part of the Climate Action Plan process is a ban on plastic bags, which looks like it's moving forward very, very rapidly in our Zero Waste Commission and should be moving forward in the new year. So we talked a little bit about how to pay for all this stuff. A lot of the investment will come from us, people that live in Berkeley, that invest in more energy efficiency, that invest in solar. The city can be a catalyst for those things by providing, you know, minimum standards, but also by providing upfront financing, like through Berkeley First. But here are some other potential sources of revenue that we're sort of looking more deeply at now. Parking as a lever. It's never probably going to be very popular to increase the cost of parking. It is a potential source of revenue for transportation demand management, and there is a sort of poetic justice to raising the price of parking and then using that to provide better alternative transportation service in Berkeley, but that's an issue where there'll be a lot of debate on. A transportation services fee, any new development would have to pay for its impact on transportation within Berkeley. An open space fee, I mentioned earlier, with the question about green space or new development, would have to contribute to enhancing green or open space in the community. And then carbon tax. Right now, the only city in the country that has a carbon tax is the city of Boulder, Colorado. It's a small tax on residential, commercial, and industrial electricity and natural gas consumption. Something similar could be done here. The initial idea is not to punish energy consumption, but instead to generate revenue that could be used to provide, you know, increased services to homeowners and to tenants and to business owners to make their homes more energy efficient and to utilize renewables.
Why do you think it could be done?
Huh?
Why do you think that could be done here?
Why do
city
I think
it has no control over any reporting about PG&E?
One idea is that right now the utility users tax is something that we already pay and that the PG&E already collects for the city and then provides back to the city, and so using that as a vehicle is one of the ways that we look at it. All right, so here's where the climate action plan is. I'm sorry this took so long, but I did answer a lot of your questions in the meantime. If you want to look at the full plan, it's here. And now I can take a few more questions as well. Yes, sir.
I came late because I worked late, and someone has said this before, tell me and I'll shut up right away.
Go ahead.
Something under half of my Berkeley trips are by car. It's a 1989 Volkswagen Jetta, which gets 40 miles per gallon on the highway. And I have 55,000 miles on the car in the last 17 years.
Wow.
In the city, instead of 40 miles per gallon, I get 16. And I'm trying to coast as much as I can down gradual grades, but use engine braking on the steep ones.
Right.
The reason for the 16 is very clear. It's the stop, four-way stops every single block, with rare exceptions. It's my belief that there are other ways of ensuring pedestrian safety. It's residential intersections like all around here. I don't want to take any more time in describing how.
Right.
Probably most of you would know yourselves, you know, various ways. But has anyone ever looked at the difference between 40 and 16? What does that do to transportation?
Yeah, that's significant.
Okay.
That's significant. Your solution would be a sort of a smoother flow so you could coast through some of those intersections.
Then let me mention the bicycle. When they started putting up all these signs, I'm calling the former city council person, my new person, and said, I thought you were trying to support bicycles, and here it takes me a block to get up to 18 miles an hour, and then bam, there's another stop sign.
Yes.
And I thought you were trying to encourage bicycling, not discourage it.
So let me cut you off because we don't have much time. One of the recommendations in the plan is to replace those stop signs with yield signs.
Good. As you have already in the circle, and I will tell you what she said. She said, well, we thought all the bicycles would just go through the stop sign.
very quickly, Deborah, can you come here for a second? You know, a lot of people that have asked me over the past months, you know, what this climate action plan is great, but what can I do right now? What can I do today? What can I do tomorrow to reduce my greenhouse gas emissions? So I wanted to introduce Deborah, who works for the Ecology Center and is running a program there that's focused on a book called The Low Carbon Diet. And she's here to invite all of you and your friends and colleagues to get involved in this program. So real quickly, and then I'll take a few more questions.
Right. So if you're wondering, well, what can I do in my house? What can I do at my workplace among my group of friends that eat together every week, but we're getting food, we don't exactly know where it came from, where I know at my home to be more efficient? We invite you to either come to the Ecology Center for 4 sessions over the course of 1 month, or to gather a group of friends, co-workers, congregation members, neighbors. We will give you the tools to form what's called a climate change action group. And we do use this curriculum, which is divided into 4 weeks, each focusing on a different aspect of your personal and community carbon footprint. You calculate your carbon footprint, make a measurable action plan to reduce it, and then engage in those actions. Having the rest of the community members there ensures that you have accountability, but also an exchange of information, resources, support. So we invite anybody who's interested. We will be starting new groups in January. They're generally on Monday, Tuesday, Friday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Ecology Center. Or if you'd like to form your own group, it's very straightforward. You don't need to know, you don't need to be Timothy and have a tremendous amount of information. You don't need to be Bruce and know everything about climate change or have experience facilitating. We'll make it easy for you. I'm going to hand out these flyers. My email address is here, and I do encourage you to get in touch if you're interested in participating.
Thank you. And there's a workshop in January 28th, right?
Yes.
January 28th, we're going to be holding a workshop for basically train people on how to use a low-carbon diet. The first 50 people get a free book. Yeah.
It seems like, this is a phenomenal idea, what you just said. Like, people have to be aware. And, you know, homeowners who are up for efficiency ideas are great. But, we're talking about people who are aware of the issue, who care and have the time and the money to care. And a lot of people, like, really don't even know there's a problem. I mean, there are a lot of people who know there is, but a lot of people just don't even think that there's really an issue. And so is there anything about, like, you know, a media awareness or a city awareness that, like, in our papers, on the radio, in the things that go out from the city to mail home, that's like, people, there's like a problem going on, and we're really asking everybody to do what they can.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, just a side note, I grew up in a small town near the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland, and I went home there for Thanksgiving, and it's a whole other world. It's not Berkeley, and it was a little bit taken aback by, you know, the level of awareness here versus other parts of the country. We have a long way to go. That's why what we do here matters. But the other part of your answer is, public information strategy is recommended in the plan, using radio, using local newspapers, columns, articles about what you can do type of thing. We are organizing a door-to-door campaign in the spring where we actually knock on thousands of doors, hopefully, and provide information about what you can do right now to address your greenhouse gas emissions. Lots of things that we can do. I should note that the city government is one player in this community. And if it's just the city government, it's not going to happen. And it's not just the city government. There's lots of community groups and individuals that are active, but really has to be a collaborative effort. Even in Berkeley, thousands of people have no clue. No clue. Yeah?
When it comes to transportation, I'd like to comment. You cannot stress too much the importance of public safety. I mean, personally, for myself and other people, there are places I could walk and would love to walk. I will not do it.
Yeah.
At night, and this is in the North Berkeley area, all over town. Public safety is a very serious problem. Mm-hmm. It stops people from using transit. It stops people from walking.
Yeah.
And until the city addresses that, a lot of this will amount to nothing because people just do not feel safe in many, many parts of town. The crime rate has gone up substantially, and so this has got to be put in the equation because there are so many wonderful plans for open space and transit that come to nothing because of everyday social problems. So I'm addressing this to our council members. You know, people are going to stay in their cars unless they really feel safe walking around.
Yeah, people are going to drive unless the alternative to that is equally as safe, equally as convenient. You know, it has to be an easy choice, really, for people to make if we're going to achieve
Absolutely.
A scale change.
And now it's an easy choice not to take transit.
This gentleman wants to know if you're worried about street crossings or something else.
Me?
No. I think you're more worried about front lines.
Muggings. I mean, even in dense areas, the UC community, the students, I mean, the crime is relentless and it's getting worse. So something that will ruin everything.
So I'm going to take two more questions, or three. There's three hands raised, and then we'll end. But I can stick around if there are additional questions, and I wanted to turn it back over to Gordon after these three questions are asked. Yeah.
First, I thought you were a fellow Marylander with those O's that you had. Anyway, my question is, first of all, great job. Interesting, very informative. How are you going to get the crisis atmosphere or something, how are you going to get the oomph to do the things that we need to do? Like you were talking about the school choices, the barriers in the streets, the four-way stop. I mean, these are pretty radical things that people have to really change the way they do things. And this seems to me like it's nice, but that target is just a pipe dream. Now, how are you going to get the oomph to actually make some of these things
scale
happen?
Scale of change that's necessary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like it all looks good.
I think, frankly, we don't know how to get to 80%. By 2050. This plan really focuses on the next 10 to 20 years and what we can do in the short term, medium term, to achieve significant reductions. And it rests on people making different decisions about it's not only individuals that are part of the problem. In fact, businesses and industries are a big part of the problem. It's not just greenwashing by saying, if you change your light bulbs, we're all set. That's not what it's like. And that scale of change, I don't know that we know how to we have to achieve it. I mean, the plan recommends a lot of different strategies for engaging people in this effort, but it takes more. It really takes a movement. It takes voting a movement, which means it has to be the city, groups like the Ecology Center, neighborhood associations, businesses, all working together on this. And right now, we're not there yet, even in Berkeley. So, stuff. Yeah.
I think another organization that needs to get on board is the REN board, particularly if you're going to have property owners be required to enforce these things with regard to their tenants, because the REN board is essentially the organization that's between that relationship.
Yes, I appreciate that suggestion, and we've had a series of meetings with them on that very specific topic. So they're looking at it, and they provide specific comments on the climate action plan. So moving forward, we will be working with them. We have one more in the back.
I think it was me.
Oh, it was you? Okay, sorry.
Yeah. I have my hand up because those are the
All right.
Actually, it's two minor points, but Rick, they're not minor, they're big. Are we going to take a look through your activities at the impact of earthquake, the threat of the earthquake, and how we might be building our plans a bit around that? And second, are we going to try to predict where Berkeley will be at the new temperature level, whatever that is, within whatever range, on the 40-year plan, and what that might mean to how we build infrastructure?
Mm-hmm.
Are either of those on the table?
The sort of how our city adapts to a rising temperature is very much on the table, and there's a significant amount of time dedicated to that in the climate action plan. We're at the beginning of stages of looking at that, though.
Sure.
So the plan sort of recommends more planning, unfortunately, on adaptation. But starting to take a look at that with what is out in front of most cities.
And what about earthquake?
The earthquake issue is not specifically mentioned in the plan. So if you have specific recommendations on that, send me an email or give me a call, and we can talk more about it. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to make a pitch for something that would cause a lot of energy efficiency and use, and that's the idea of shared housing and the city encouraging shared housing. So I'd like to mesh that with the idea that, two ideas actually, that many people like myself who are growing older and are single would benefit in terms of being able to age in place and do other things if they need community living arrangements with other people. We have a lot of one person, one family dwellings in Berkeley that can accommodate other people. And the city could help to make that possible and make it easier for people to make that decision, which is a big decision, rather than going into residential living or what have you. That would be a big step forward for people. I'd also like to say that that's important in the current economic climate for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And also, if Berkeley could be a refuge city for people being foreclosed on at this point, so that people would have alternatives to move here in safe transition when that happens. Because, people are moving, are needing to move out of homes into shared living or apartment buildings at this point. And if there could be incentives for landlords or other people to help that.
Okay, thank you. All right, we're going to have to wrap up. I want to turn it back over to Gordon.
I just want to, one, thank everybody for coming. Two, say that, this is a very complex problem. I think it also needs to be tailored to Berkeley, and that's where we need your input. There's a lot of ideas out there. Some are going to work. Some maybe not work well. Some are not going to work so well. So and it's going to take individual commitment. And I think, as Timothy said, the impact we can have is not necessarily what we individually do is going to, make all that difference in the CO2 in the planet. But if we come up with successful solutions, other people copy us, we can have a big impact. And before we let you go, I'd like to let Chris say some final words if he wants. Chris, do you want to say something? Okay. All right. Thank you all for coming out. And,
thank you.
Give us your input by email and other ways, too. You don't have to do it by...